You're listening to a podcast from the Media Motel. Coming up this week on episode 217, the Department of Work and Pensions has admitted making up comments from supposed benefits claimants that appeared in a leaflet about sanctions. There's a thing. Why cricket and picnics go together so well. Some bands are very, very irritating. We have a list of them. And we have another four great tracks of music, including this from The Teardrop Explodes.
Number 18 in the UK in 1981, Teardrop Explodes and Treason. This is the Media Motel podcast. There was a brief bit of concern on Twitter during the day when Julian Cope, today on Friday, Julian Cope started trending on Twitter and everybody got a bit worried. But it turned out that it was okay because they were just playing an old session of his on Six Music and that's why it was trending. It was a bit of a panic for a
moment.
They
need to be careful what they're playing on Six Music.
Absolutely.
Also, very encouraging that Six Music trends in that way. That is nice.
Yes, but it did set the nation on edge for a moment till they realised. I'm Terence Ronald Anthony St. Joseph Dackham, and look, she's Juliet Lucy Harris.
Hello, I still am. I do keep trying not to be, but it's just a thing that keeps occurring. Yeah. We're all sort of learning to live with it, I think, really.
I've been working this week on anagrams of Juliet Lucy Harris.
I like the fact you've told me this now we've gone live. That's a good time to break that.
I saved this going? I saved this for you.
There's at least one four-letter word in there, which is unfortunate.
Oh, no, no, gosh, no. I've got three that I've been working on. I may do some more for next week. Anyway, I've got Curliest Hair July, which isn't that great, but it does make sense. Chisel Jewelry Ritual.
That's quite good, actually. I might nick that for a future album title.
Yeah, or a song, Marky Smith probably writing that song.
I was going to say, right? He's a chisel, jewel, ritual, yeah.
And finally, Hurl Italy Juices.
Well, someone's got to make a living out of these things, haven't they? So it sounds like sort of it makes me think of recalcitrant England football fans on a trip abroad, possibly. If Italy ever hosts the World Cup again, I suspect that might be a tabloid headline.
Yeah, throwing those new little bullet juices that are so trendy.
I was
going to
say, somewhere in an East London suburb near you, there will be a Hurl Italian Juices bar, won't there?
Of some sort, run by
enterprising souls in beards.
Jules, there's a game show on BBC Five Live, which ends with a round entitled Defend the Indefensible.
Right, OK.
And I feel I'm entering that territory in the next few minutes.
I'm just clinging onto the arms of my chair as I speak.
I think you may need to. Here's the thing. If you go to the supermarket and you buy a breakfast cereal.
Yes.
And on the front of the packet, there'll be a portrayal of how you might serve up that cereal, perhaps with a finely chopped banana or raspberry added.
Or some milk, for those of us that are quite old-fashioned about these things.
You old-fashioned people may well do that. And there'll be a caption that says, serving suggestion.
Right, OK.
Now, everyone knows that this is for illustrative purposes only.
This is true.
Yeah, you don't have to make your cereal that way. And purchasers don't expect the box of cereal to contain a bunch of bananas. Now, when the Department of Work and Pensions did the same thing on a leaflet explaining the sanctions process, the left-wing press descended on the concept like vultures at a roadkill. The examples in the leaflet were for illustration, just like the serving suggestion on a cereal packet. Juliet, Lucy, what's wrong with you people?
Well, what can I say? I speak for all of my people across Britain when I say, firstly, to take your point in a slightly literal way, it does not say serving suggestion or anything like it on these leaflets, can I just point out. It does not say, whatever her name is, Sarah is on this for it. Sarah's story is in the link to the thing I'm looking at. It doesn't say at any point on this, Sarah is not a real person. Sarah is just a random example. And apparently the reason why that this was come across by an organisation called Welfare Weekly, who are a sort of a disability rights type sort of organisation. So actually, in true, journalism style, they got the story from someone else, but they spotted it because apparently she was on another leaflet. She was on Sarah was on a, I can't remember what it was. It was some other government department leaflet.
And it's someone, a stock photo, Juliet.
Yes, I know, but let me finish, Sir Terence of Dacombe. Thank you. I can't remember all your other names, but I would use them in a disapproving way if I could. I just feel that people claiming benefits, we might get on to talking about benefit fraud, but vulnerable people in society who are in a position of vulnerability that such means they have to claim benefits, I don't feel they are analogous with a bowl of cereal, to be brutally honest. I don't feel that a retail circumstance where you buy a bowl of cereal, think, oh, that looks nice, or you buy some mozzarella and think, oh, that looks nice, or I could have it in a salad, but you know what, I think I'll just have it on toast. Maybe that's just me, I don't know. That's a different circumstance to them going, look at this lady, she's turned her life around because she wrote a CV and she didn't have her benefits stopped, and she wasn't going to write a CV and she thought she was going to have her benefits stopped, and now she has. Look, that could be you, except this isn't anyone. It's just an example. And I have to say that I do feel it is, we may disagree on this, but my personal view is that I do feel it is toying with the vulnerable. And I do feel that in light of other news reports of there being difficulties with the sanctions system, and particularly that the Parliamentary Select Committee on the Department of Work and Pensions, which I feel is a fairly sort of legit source, perhaps more legit than some of our left wing press, when they are saying that there are problems with the sanctions system and it seems to be designed to punish rather than to help people back to work, when it is being released in that context, I do have a problem with it, I must admit.
The sanctions process itself, moving on to that, I think it seems rather fair to me, and I'll just quickly say why. If you can't find work, then we have the safety net of benefits, and I fully support that. It's the mark of a civilized society. No problem there. But to receive the job seeker's allowance, you should be available for work. You are saying, you know, I'm a job seeker. I want this job seeker's allowance. So you also have to actively seek work and keep a record of your search, which again seems reasonable to me. Now, in addition to that, if you've been unable to find work by yourself after a period of time, you may be referred to the work programme, which is a commitment to the job seeker for more intensive support in finding work. Now, here's my, you know, this is my bit. If the job seeker fails to keep to their commitment to find work and be available and actively seeking work, then sanctions apply. That seems very reasonable to me. You know, I really do want to know what the argument against that is.
Well, I think, right, I don't disagree with a lot of what you're saying, but I think the problem is that there have been a lot of examples. I mean, I don't have sources on this, which is unfortunate, but there have been lots of reports in the press of sanctions being used in a very blanket way. There have been people that have worked for job centres that have Job Centre Plus and all that sort of thing that have then gone to the press and gone, look, you know, we weren't sanctioning people for genuine reasons. We were being told to find as many reasons to sanction people as possible because we have targets that we have to meet to show that the government is sanctioning people, which I feel is ideological rather than for a purpose. But I do agree that, you know, I mean, I've claimed job seekers allowance before. I did when I left law college, and I claimed it for about 6 or 7 weeks. I looked for work during that time. This would have been in about 2006. So actually, they were pretty all right to me, really. I went in with all of my covering letters that I'd written in a CV, and that was fine. And in the end, I got a job. And I think most of my job seeker's allowance was back paid because you know, that was the way that it works. So I don't have a problem with having to play, you know, do the thing and you know, make sure that you know, you're getting these benefits for a reason. Where I do have a problem is where it's being used to sanction people, for example, who have gone to funerals and told the job centre and this haven't been actioned.
Oh, well, that's...
And actually, there are, you say this, and because you're a decent person, you agree. But the problem is that there seem to be a lot of examples of this, and there does seem to be a bit of a narrative. Okay. Now, I agree with you, but I think.
But sometimes these stories come out, and then one wonders whether, you know, because obviously that on its own, you think, well, that's outrageous. Because I wonder whether, you know, whether there's more to it than meets the eye. Because these decisions, and I checked on this today, they have to go to an independent, the department calls them a decision maker. So it's not the bloke or woman on the front line that says, right, I'm stopping your benefits. They recommend you'll pass the issue on, but an independent person makes the decision. Then there's an appeals process. And what a lot of people don't know is that even if you get your benefits sanctioned and therefore stopped, you don't have to go without. There is a hardship payment process which you can claim, and you
problem is though is that if you've got people that are claiming, for example, sickness benefit or something like that,
Julia, that's very, very different. I'm talking about job seekers allowance.
Well, okay,
sickness is a different thing.
Okay, then. So if you've got someone that's claiming job seekers allowance, let me use me as an example. If you know, I work in an industry which is buoyant at the moment, but if there was an economic downturn, I could easily lose my job tomorrow, as indeed a lot of my former colleagues did during the last downturn. If you've got a sort of a downturn that affects all of the jobs in that industry, there aren't necessarily other jobs to go to. And I think there are lots of industries that are like this. So I could have a situation where I lose my job, you know, I write when looking for a training contract, I wrote hundreds of letters to places trying to find a training contract, hundreds of places, and probably got about 8 responses and maybe 1 interview out of that. And if it gets to a stage where you are absolutely busting a gut, yeah, you're not claiming sickness benefit, but if you want to work, if you genuinely want to work and you were looking for work and you can't find it, it is horrendously demoralising. You then become quite vulnerable in a way. You then become more prone to you know, being knocked, you know, particularly if you've got, you know, say that you're knocked flat with the flu, you live by yourself, you don't have family, you can't get to the job centre. My problem with it is that I don't think it's just as simple. I think that people that are looking for jobs, if they're not genuinely looking for jobs, then I agree with you. But if they are genuinely looking for jobs, I think that you can easily become quite vulnerable. And I worry. I mean, this is where, you know, we will disagree, because I think, you know, we come from slightly different places on you know, the spectrum politically. But sure. I have concerns about the way in which this, the system is being administered. And can I just point out as well, I know we're talking about job seekers at the moment, but to widen it and to show that I am, of course, impartial and open-minded, I didn't agree with the Labour Party introducing ATOS to the benefits assessment process in the first place. So I am not just blaming one regime for this. I think it's a load of regimes. And the welfare system has to work for everyone. I agree with that. But equally, I do feel that sometimes it is being used as a blunt instrument. The fact that there have been some deaths reported as a result of you know, the people not being given benefits and insulin be running out, the chap that died because he didn't have any, you know, electricity to run the fridge. Things like that worry me. They shouldn't be happening. And this is why I am offended by the fact that they're using false things, because it feels to me, if you've got a system that's working properly, that's doing what you're saying it's doing for the reasons that you'll say that you're doing it, you shouldn't have to come up with fake examples.
While we're walking this tightrope, I want to see what you think about another, what I think is equally, in my view, fallacious arguments against another aspect of government policy, which is the spare room subsidy.
Yes.
You'll call it the bedroom
tax.
I was
not going to, but now you've goaded me into it. Yes, I will.
Well, people tend to forget.
Still not my favourite tax of the last government. The pasty tax was my all-time favourite, I think. It was
a classic of its time.
It was
people tend to forget that the spare room subsidy only applies when the taxpayer is funding housing benefit for those who can't afford the property that they're renting. So bearing in mind it only applies to public sector housing, if you have, and this is my example, if you have a single person living in a four-bedroom house at the taxpayer's expense, and I know this is simplified, but next door there's a young family, say in their 30s with three children, and they're living in a one-bedroom flat, that to me isn't fair. Shouldn't it be the other way round? And if that single person refuses to leave their public-funded four-bedroom house, isn't it perfectly fair that they should be asked to pay towards the parts of the property that, you know, they're not using?
Well, on the face of it, yes, I am inclined to agree. I think that public housing obviously has to serve the public. And as a side point, I think the housing benefit system is increasingly unfit for purpose, because it is not being paid into the pockets of people that need it. It's being paid into landlords' pockets. And I think is being used, which is a bit ironic given what I do for a living, but it's being used to subsidise, you know, subsidised buy-to-let landlords, some of whom are very decent, but quite a lot of whom aren't. And again, off the backs of the vulnerable. And I find the housing benefit system to be offensive, not because I don't think people should be claiming welfare, far from it, because I think, or social security, as I prefer to call it, but I don't think the housing benefit system is fit for purpose. But aside from that, looking at the bedrooms again, and this is a similar sort of argument to me, and again, we may not agree on this, but again, there are, as well as there being, for every report, and I don't know if I've just read this because I do try and read a range of press. I don't just stick to My Guardian. I do try to read some other things as well. Your Telegraph, for example, occasionally as well. I find it, I for every story I've found of, you know, this family living in this 8-bedroom house in Ealing and it's worth $3 million. Isn't this appalling? I've also found stories, perhaps more stories, of people who, for example, have to keep, who are seriously ill, that have to keep equipment in a second bedroom, being told to move. People who have to, I mean, Yvette Cooper told this story earlier in the week of when she was out canvassing for the general election, that she met someone who had a 2-bedroom house and had it because she had to put her grandchild up at the weekends because the grandchild worked shifts or something. The grandchild was a old enough.
I saw that story. Sorry to interrupt Juliet. But,
why not?
I saw that story too from Yvette Cooper, and it did strike me. Now, you know, you can condemn me as an evil man. Why couldn't that grandchild sleep on the sofa?
Well, I just don't.
Because if you or I have more people that come round to stay, we'd all want to have a handful of spare rooms for storage or for when people come to stay. But in the private sector, we own or rent property that we can afford. And I don't expect taxpayers to add extra rooms for my convenience. So if you say, I don't know how many bedrooms you've got in your property,
I've got
one or two. True. Now, if you had four people coming to stay, you'd have to say, well, I'm afraid one of you is going to have to sleep on the sofa. You wouldn't expect the local authority to house...
No, I wouldn't, but I consider that to be a leisure purpose. You know, my people, left-wing journalists and otherwise, coming to stay, that's a different purpose to me than... People having, I mean, I personally think if you're a young person that's working, and we don't know the circumstances of this chap's job, the way the story was told, we don't know the circumstances behind it, but the way the story was told, it suggested that the grandchild's circumstances was such that there was nowhere else they could stay. And I just feel that it's not unreasonable for people to... I don't think sleeping on a sofa if you're working... I just find it a very odd situation to be in, that we castigate people for not working and claiming benefits, yet we then castigate people for, whilst you're working, wanting to live in reasonable conditions. Now, I do understand what you say about sort of funding the public, you know, that sort of thing. But I think the problem is not necessarily the idea of the system, but the way in which the system is enforced. And the problem is that when you've got people, when you've got, you know, local authorities enforcing this system whereby, you know, they're saying to people who live in houses where you've got medical equipment and stuff in the other room, oh, you've got to move. The problem is that when you hear stories like that, that for me damages my credibility in the system as much as it damages your credibility in the system when you hear of one person with a four-bedroom house. So I have difficulties because, yes, we cannot be expected to find it everyone, but I think a lot of the cases are genuine, and I feel it lacks humanity. That's just my view, but I can see your arguments too.
We're back with the equally contentious issue of catering picnics at cricket matches.
we do with all the hardcore stuff here, don't we?
Absolutely. After this intriguing track from Public Service Broadcasting.
This is Moscow. This is Moscow calling. On the 12th of April, the Soviet Union orbited a spaceship around the Earth with a man on board. The astronaut is a Soviet citizen, Major Gagarin Yuri Alekseyevich.
Cosmonaut. The first to open the door into the unknown. The first to step over the threshold of our homeland. The whole planet knew him and loved him.
Gagarin.
Was it hazardous? Yes, it was. The first strides into the unknown were about to be made. The hero who blazed the trail for the stars.
One of us was with Yuri Gagarin as he orbited the Earth 190 miles above us. Astronauts are back. I can see forests, rivers, cumulus clouds all around. Everything's so beautiful. It's wonderful. It's wonderful.
We'll be right back.
Gagarin.
And Terence was right. That was indeed public service broadcasting, or as I keep calling them, public sector broadcasting, which is unfortunate and perhaps somewhat apt given what we've just been speaking about.
Yeah.
Gagarin. And that's they're a band who I've always meant to get into and have never quite got around to it. And I went away on holiday recently and, as I always seem to do, bought a load of music. And I was delighted to find a record shop in Shrewsbury. I can't remember its name now, and I'm terribly sorry, but it's only just opened and you should go because they've got loads of vinyl and the man's really nice. And he's going to do a coffee shop upstairs with cold food, but he told me this, but I wanted to buy their album. I bought their second album, The Race for Space, and it's a terrific record. That's probably the pick from it, but it's they do lots of things where they splice archive footage across the top of largely rock slash dancey songs, and apparently they have a very good live show as well where they show films on the back, and it's just my sort of thing. It's not very often that I fall deeply in love with bands, but I think public service broadcasting are me forever, I suspect.
I played it. I absolutely love it. I played this a lot since you told me you were picking this a few days ago. I played it a lot. Absolutely love it. I was only 5 years old, but I do remember the sensation when Yuri Gagarin went into space and orbited the Earth. I can still, in my memory, I can still see the black and white photos on the front pages of the newspapers. And I know it just, his mission seemed kind of both exhilarating and terrifying to the 5 year old.
I can imagine it was another world, literally, wasn't it?
It was
very febrile ground for inspiring bands and songs generally. I very nearly made my second pick Yuri G by PJ Harvey because I feel the two would have gone together quite well. Also, the first dog in space was called Laker, you may know this, and there was a band called Laker. And in fact, I think one of Laker went on to be in PJ Harvey's backing band. Didn't
the real Laker not come back though?
I think the real Laker had a story which was brushed aside slightly, wasn't it? But lots of inspiration, perhaps cheery or otherwise, from space for bands generally.
Yes, Jules, I fear we may be on opposite sides again now.
This just keeps happening, doesn't it? Anyone would think that we'd kind of manufactured this situation to maintain listeners, which who does that? I mean, really.
That would be an outrage. We're looking at the joys or otherwise of picnicking. And in particular, I suspect you're something of a fan of combining a picnic with cricket.
Yeah, absolutely. Two of God's greatest inventions, for those that believe in him, her, it or them. I'm a big fan of eating generally, actually, particularly in every circumstance I can fit it in. So when you're particularly sitting down's a good time for me eating wise. So when you're watching cricket, that is a very good time to sit down. Also when fielding sometimes as well, when I used to play cricket, although I never actually ate a pork pie whilst fielding. That was the only frontier that I didn't embrace as a lazy fielder. But yes, I am a fan of what an acquaintance of mine would call snacksidents. I'm a very, very big fan of that. And also cricket. So for me, that sounds like a very nice day out, unless you sit next to someone with a megaphone.
Oh God, or a drum.
Yes.
I must have been frightened by a Pace sandwich when I was a child.
Oh dear.
Because I get a Pace sandwich
hell by Terence Dackham.
I get a little feverish and kind of edgy at the thought of picnics, and especially picnics at cricket.
What distresses you about it, my friend?
Well, I do spend several days at Lord's each summer watching the cricket from the heady world of the pavilion.
Wow.
And there's a group of friends who turn up to each match. And they're kind of burdened with cool bags and hampers, which are opened within seconds of their arrival at the ground. And champagne is passed around in plastic flutes.
Oh, absolutely.
And all sorts of food stuff emerges through the day. They obviously adore it. But for me, these sort of situations, it kind of leads me close to a panic attack, because being a fussy eater in these situations, I always get handed some exotic cheesy thing, possibly floating on oysters or something.
Dear.
And I
think
kind of
you
feel
have a different. Well, firstly,
rise.
I think you have a different social circle to me. I must admit, we have a far more Lidl-based picnic when I go with my pals. I'm sorry. I am genuinely sorry to hear of your picnic-related distress, because it's such an enjoyable thing, and I'm so sorry you can't participate in it. I think the thing is, I'm not an especially fussy eater, and also I think the key to picnics is to make them collaborative. So someone does one thing and someone else does another thing, and to talk beforehand. And you,
well, but you don't know if they've washed their hands, Jules.
Now you sound like a former paramour of mine who Jess would often refuse to shake hands with me if she'd suspected that I'd done things like, you know, not necessarily using a park toilet if it was locked and things like that. I'm far more laid back about these things, which makes me a terrible person, I know, on every level. But I just really like picnics and I trust the people I know. Maybe I'm too trusting. This is saying a lot about our psychology, isn't it, Pete?
It is. But you see, there's another element to all this. There's the hazards of eating outdoors. The wasps, the gulls, the pigeons.
Oh, yes, the wasps are
all
a pain.
All other manner of God's fine creatures, ants, you know.
But if you're in
determined...
a pavilion, haven't you got a roof over you?
Oh, no, you can't eat in the pavilion. You have to eat outside on the benches, yeah. And all these creatures, they're determined to do all they can to ruin the experience. And also, everything wrapped in silver foil or trapped in Tupperware gets soggy and sweaty. Mm. And consequently, everything tastes like damp carbon. Well, go to a restaurant. They're professionals at the catering game.
But I really like my peanut butter sandwiches. They're really good. And also, we're obviously coming from different worlds, because for me, the biggest treat when I was younger, when I went to school and my mum had packed my lunch for me, was in the summer. I just used to play football continually, so sometimes wouldn't eat my lunch. But on the occasions that I did, the best sandwich, A, had pate in it, and B, the butter had melted where it had got really hot. And for me, that was ideal. And for you, it isn't. And I thought this would be a really cheery thing to bring us up after the Department of Work and Pensions. And I'm terribly sorry to have wrought this upon you. So when it comes to fantasy picnic elements, yours is basically a restaurant with some food in it, isn't it? That's your favourite picnic element.
Oh, now we're talking. Yes. I don't know whether you find this at football and the cricket you go to, but I think it's also wise to avoid the in-house catering at almost all sporting events, because particularly at football matches where, you know, you'll pay £5.50 for a lightly warmed hamburger that costs the caterers 5p wholesale.
Well, I agree. And as someone that has been a long-term non-league football fan, some of the grounds are, I mean, you talk about your £5.50 hamburgers at your Stamford Bridges I was going to say hybrids, I'm talking in old money, but you know, in your big football grounds, your Old Travers and such like. Having eaten some efforts in non-league grounds, I'm genuinely pleased that I'm still alive, frankly. I think it goes far beyond. But having said that, I don't know. I go and watch football at the Dripping Pan in Lewes quite a lot. They not only is a community-owned football club, so I'm genuinely able to say that I own a football club, because I do. I own a £30 share in Lewes, and my fellow shareholders did include Nigella Lawson at one point, which was quite exciting. But I go there quite a lot to watch them, because they also have an excellent women's team, some of whom have gone on to play for Chelsea and England, and they play on Sundays, and that is a delightful way to watch football. And actually, the nicest picnic I've ever had was watching non-league football, because they sell beer, and again, you talk about people opening their things seconds after the thing's begun. I think my unfinest hour was having drunk 3/4 of a pint before they'd even kicked off, so I did feel a bit bad about that. But my friend, watching women's football in Lewes on a Sunday is lovely, because it's not at all like a football match, in that you see loads of people you know and people take their kids. And I remember sat once between one of my friends that was doing her knitting, so every so often I had to hold her hand up so that she could measure how long a glove was, and the other side someone, "Oh, I've made some brownies, would you like some?" and opened a metal tin with some freshly baked brownies in. So I sat with my pint of Harvey's in one hand and my lovely brownie in the other hand, watching some knitting. So actually, I think in the right circumstances, with a fair wind, it wasn't a wet day, and it was I can't remember if it was autumn or spring, but it was a fairly moderate sort of season. On a right day, when everything's fair and good, picnics can work.
I tell you what, catering at music events, that's a subject for another day.
I
think
I'd have to remortgage to buy some catering at a music event, I think.
We'll try and find some form of agreement shortly, but we're back discussing bands that irritate.
This seems a more like we can unite in hate, I hope, or at least severe annoyance.
We may be able to bond over that subject. Bands that are irritating, after this, from the very non-irritating Tears for Fears.
Advice for the young at heart.
Thank you.
From 26 years ago, when Tears for Fears were falling apart, essentially, it's the only track on the Sowing the Seeds of Love album with Kurt Smith on lead vocals. Tears for Fears, Advice for the Young at Heart.
Which I would suspect would include Don't Have Roland on Vocals Anymore, album, as far as I'm concerned.
I was looking at the video for Advice for the Young at Heart earlier today, and shot at the time, of course. It's very illuminating because the theme is a sort of sense of joie de vivre. Mm. But if you check out the cutaway shots and the resting faces of Roland and Kurt, you kind of gain an insight into their troubled world with poor old Alita Adams keeping the peace.
I felt she did possibly Nobel Prize winning work in that video. She did extremely well, I felt.
She really did. Anyway, that's from my top 20 of all time. Really? Advice for the Young at Heart.
Good choice. One of my finest youthful memories was involved Tears for Fears, and I must have been, and this is going to depress everybody and I'm sorry, but I must have been about 5, and I was cheerily skipping along, and I would still do this now, actually. My brain still works in the same way. I always have music running through my brain. And I skipped down a hill singing Everybody Wants to Rule the World by Tears for Fears, because it's got a lovely skippy beat that you can really get up to.
Yeah,
and unfortunately, once I reached the bottom of the hill, I'd realised that the rest of my scattered family were, in fact, at the top of the hill, frenziedly screaming my name because I'd gone the wrong way, and I got to the bottom of the hill, and it was all Tears for Fears' fault. So they've got a lot to answer for in many ways, old Roland and Kurt, I think.
There are some bands or artists that they're just so irritating. And I don't particularly mean groups such as U2, where, two members are so evidently punchable.
Who's the other one, by the way, apart from Bono?
Oh, The Edge.
Oh, fair enough.
It's
that hat, isn't it?
It's the hat. He wears it indoors. We know he's bald. I feel sorry for him, but, get a transplant or something. We know you're bald, mate. And also, in your late 50s, imagine you're going to the dentist. The Edge. It's the edge here. In the dry cleaners, yeah, I'm just bringing this It's for edge the. I mean, you know, come on. It might be funny in college when you're 16, but, you know.
As even you two once were.
Yeah. No, I mean bands that could have, should have, ought to have, but then somehow threw it all away. And we're each going to give a few examples, I believe. Hmm. And I'm starting with UB40. Hard to recall now that they started as a sort of post-punk protest group.
Well, that's where the name came from, wasn't it? It was the unemployment form, wasn't it?
Unemployment application form.
Which links us back to Nazzily to earlier on as well, doesn't it?
There we are. Yes, I bet they never applied for the spare room. No, don't go into that.
Stop it.
Let it go. Unemployment application form, as you say.
They were quite edgy, weren't they, when they started?
They were a terrific start with edgy, politico, protest reggae, Food for Thought, King, One in Ten.
Well, One in Ten is fantastic, I agree.
Marvellous. But within 2 years of One in Ten, they were more well known for anodyne, anemic cover versions of Red, Red Wine and Many Rivers to Cross. And then to make it worse, we've then had 30 years of the same. And we've ended in a painful split and bankruptcy for, I think, almost all members. So first into the room 101 of irritating groups. UB40, get in.
Bang, as they do on the TV show. Yeah, no, I agree. And also, I suffer from colleagues at work, three of whom have constantly badgered me to listen to Labour of Love by UB40 because they go on about what a great album it is. And it really is the most hateful nonsense, isn't it? And it's difficult because I like to think of myself as a team player in the office, but I can't be when it comes to UB40. I'm just not on board.
What's your first pick, Jules?
Distressingly, because we've made this into a Room 101 scenario, this distresses me even more. But it's more. I'm not angry. I'm just disappointed, really, because this is probably one of my favourite bands of all time. I love Elastica, possibly more than some people love their children. And and they were just the greatest band for me. I know that various people listening are going to fulminate about how they ripped off various other bands, but to which I reply with Oscar Wilde's talent borrows, genius steals. And eventually they were sued successfully, so everybody won in the end. But I loved Elastica. I thought they looked perfect. They looked exactly like a band should look. They did fantastic songs. I loved that album, Elastica, so much. They were absolutely brilliant. That came out in 95. So what did they do? Did they capitalise on their success? Did they roar forward? No, they basically all got addicted to heroin and spent 5 years and a six-figure sum trying to record a second album, which they eventually released after much rancour and kicking one of the main songwriters out of the band in 2000, limped on for a bit. Ironically, the album itself sounded like they had an EP beforehand and the album itself, and they both sounded like we probably could have. But they were very, I enjoyed them, but I can't imagine they would have taken more than a couple of weeks in the studio to put together. There are hundreds, possibly rumoured thousands of songs and bits of stuff that wasn't used. And the maddening thing was, you know, having lost all their momentum within 5 years, if they waited another 18 months, because Justine Frischmann, the singer's main complaint at the time for the lack of success of the second album was the fact that stuff like Coldplay and very kind of mainstream acoustic rock kind of stuff was the food of the day, whereas Elastica's second album, The Menace, is quite kind of scratchy and post-punky and offbeat. Ironically, if they'd waited another 18 months, they would have fallen in with the post-punk revival and probably would have had some more success. They just broke my heart because they could have been, I mean, I like the second album very much and I love their first album. They could have been enormous and they did literally throw it away. So I am terribly sad to put Elastica into Room 101, but they did literally break my heart.
There they go. My second pick is also more from sorrow than anger. Of these groups that sort of antagonise and irritate me, this may be a surprise, but it's the Beach Boys.
Controversial.
Yeah. What, you know, those golden 6 years from 1966 to 73, yes, from Pet Sounds through to Holland.
Yes.
And now, just listen to this run of singles. There's a few, so bear with me. Wouldn't it be nice? God only knows. Good vibrations, heroes and villains, darling, do it again, bluebirds over the mountain, I can hear music, breakaway, surfs up and sail on sailor.
That is beautiful, isn't it? Just phenomenal.
Just hearing the names makes you your day somewhat brighter.
It does.
And then, just as suddenly, if you like, as an eclipse of the sun, it was over. But instead, you see, what they did wrong, instead of calling it a day, as the Beatles so sensibly did.
At least they had the good grace to pack in, didn't they, when they were still amazing.
The Beach Boys' name has been tarnished and booted into the ocean at Malibu, which rusting.
Buried in the sandbox.
Yeah, below the surf in the sandbox, as variations of the lineup have, they now trudge through summer festivals fairs.
It's Brian Wilson and whoever happens to be passing on the day, isn't it? Pretty much nowadays.
It's just
Brian Wilson does not seem particularly well to me, I'd sometimes wonder to what extent this is Brian Wilson doing things and to what extent this is Brian Wilson being put on stage and then doing things, it troubles me, that aspect of it, so I'm more than inclined to agree with you on that score.
Brian hasn't been well for nearly 50 years. Mm. But no, it's kind of some endless summer of blandness karaoke. So, yeah, number two into the dumper. With regret, Jules, it's the
Beach Boys. Well, I'm terribly sorry, but I'm inclined to agree with you. And actually, my second band, who I don't feel as passionately about as I do as Elastica, but for almost exactly the same reasons I'm dumping into the dumper, are the Stone Roses. And the reason is they did exactly the same thing. They had a first, I don't get the impression their demise was as drug related, although I think they were still a feature. But their main reason for demise was constant rows with their record label and the whole Silvertone thing and not being able to get their songs released off them and a huge, long sort of expensive legal battle. They released a beautiful first album in the Stone Roses, which still sounds as fresh as a daisy. I actually quite like parts of the Second Coming, but most of it stank, and they have pretty much got rid of all their goodwill before that infamous appearance at Reading, where again they'd lost half the original lineup, and Ian Brown, there are always excuses made, but Ian Brown was not in tune at any point. Ian Brown can sing, he clearly can, but they just let themselves descend into a complete mess. The only bright spot is the fact that some of Ian Brown's later solo career stuff has been very good. But again, for having a wonderful spark and then just completely throwing it away, I'm afraid, regretfully, as much as a classic that first album is, I'm binning the Stone Roses on those grounds.
Yeah, I'm holding the door open for you to shove them in. I'm with you there. One of the greatest culprits of all is my final choice, and it's hard to believe to today's viewers of television opiate or readers of Hello magazine.
Of which I'm sure we have many in it.
Thousands. But there was a time when Rod Stewart was a rebellious, glamorous...
Oh, Rod the Mod, glamorous... yes, I love the Rod the Mod years. He was brilliant.
It's sort of down-to-earth, lovable rock star. Occasional purveyor, it has to be said, of hideous, misogynistic lyrics, but no one knew the words in 1971, so I genuinely wasn't aware. But his early albums, Every Picture Tells a Story and Never a Dull Moment, they capture a sort of confident, all-killer, no-filler period. And he self-produced those,
that's
which
interesting.
Was very...
I didn't know that. That's very
unusual for the time.
Yeah.
And they're very accomplished, dynamic productions as well. And, he was only in his early 20s. Never a Dull Moment from 1972 in particular is 33 minutes of sheer joy. Again, our on-running rule.
Yes,
of
reprise,
short.
Yes.
Yeah, yes. Amazingly, at the same time, he was running a parallel career as lead singer of The Faces and a run of 8 superb hit singles at the same time as his solo career, including Cindy Incidentally, I Know I'm Losing You, and Paul Hall Richard. And then, like the other example, something happened, something changed. And we've had a subsequent 45 years of Hollywood noodling, trophy relationships, and middle of the road mush that even Radio 2 won't play. So
if it's too mushy for daytime Radio 2, there are liquid issues, aren't there, frankly?
My third example then of irritating musicians, in he goes, Jules. There he goes, Rod Stewart.
I will not stop you from throwing Rob Stewart in, but I would like, as a sort of a side point, as I think occasionally our listeners will indulge, I don't know if you've read Tracy Thorne's book, Bedsit Disco Queen.
I have.
And she talks in it about Rod Stewart and her family's love for Rod Stewart. Mm. This is as a sort of preempting to talking about everything but the girl covering I Don't Want to Talk About It and having an enormous hit for it and being hated by the indie community forevermore for doing that. Though actually, I prefer their version. I think Tracy Thorn has a beautiful voice anyway, and I think she really got that song. You know, singers sometimes manage to make songs their own, and I think she really did. But she talks about how her whole family loved Rod Stewart to the point where even when they knew Rod Stewart was losing the plot by, you know, having speedboats and releasing single artwork whilst wearing football kits and having ridiculous girlfriends and doing all that stupid thing, they always forgave Rod Stewart everything. And I always quite like the idea of the Thorne household sort of holding Rod Stewart out on a pedestal. So yes, you may throw him in the dumpster, but eventually the Thorne household will retrieve him and put it on a pedestal.
What's your final choice?
I had so many final choices. I never knew I was filled with so much hate for various bands. I nearly put Kasabian in just because I enjoyed their first album and have found them to be so utterly witless ever since. And just the music of what a friend of mine refers to uncharitably as landfill indie. And also, it's also the sort of songs that football crowds sing, and then I think, well, maybe I should stop going to football matches, that sort of thing. But I'll keep Kasabian out just simply because I hate Metallica even more than I hate Kasabian. I loathe them anyway. They've only ever had two songs which I feel are much cop. Weirdly, I didn't hate them headlining Glastonbury because they were a metal band. I just hate them because they're Metallica. I don't hate them for any other reason. And I hated them even before Lars Ulrich's, who I always could get confused with Jan Ulrich, who was a Tour de France winner and unfortunately subsequent drug positive tester, as indeed most recent winners of the Tour de France are, rather heartbreakingly for me, but as I was raised on the Tour de France. But Lars Ulrich, even before his one man tirade against Napster, which again, we're probably on different sides of, but they've always wound me up anyway. But again, Lars Ulrich seems to be the Bono of the metal world, and that he just seems to be so selfish. I mean, admittedly, we don't have to deal with all the look at me. I do lots for charity, but I hate to talk about it. We don't have to deal with that, but we do have to deal with Lars Ulrich and Metallica. And I don't dislike metal music. I've been to see Iron Maiden before at the O2, and I loved it. It was the best thing ever. But I can't bear Metallica. I just can't deal with them. So I'm afraid Lars and all the others who I don't even know have to go in.
In they go. And I think if anybody would like to argue
or if anybody wants to send a letter bomb to my house from Metallica HQ or whatever, please do.
If you want to pick up on our choices or on anything we've said tonight, then you can get in touch with either or both of us through Twitter. I'm Sir Terence on Twitter. You're Super Jules 84,
which I still regret, but I have to live with.
But also, you're a bit more prolific on Facebook, so people can find you on Facebook as
well,
can't they?
Yes, I am available on Facebook. You will have to put up with quite a lot of my nonsense, but yes, I am around and about on Facebook. So yeah, do pop and say hello.
Before we go this week, I've got to say a big thank you to Rona Martin for her help this week. What are we playing out with this week, Jules?
This week, we as a noted sort of a programme you say, this week we are mostly playing out with Band on the Run by Wings. I don't have a particularly snazzy story about this, although it is part of my ongoing sort of personal crusade. I love songs with different sections in. I always have loved songs with all sorts of different sections in, despite the fact that Dorian Lynskey once derided Bohemian Rhapsody. He once said, honestly, if you say Bohemian Rhapsody is your favourite record, it's like saying your favourite meal is a buffet. You're just impressed by a lot going on at once. And I'm afraid that being the picnic lover that I am, yes, I do love records where lots go on at once. So as an example of that, this is, or these are, depending on whether you're American or English, Wings, and this is Band on the Run.
OK, we'll see you next week. I'm Terence Ronald Anthony St. Joseph Dacca.
And I remain Juliet Lucy Harris and your humble servant.
We'll see you next time.
Goodbye.
stuck inside these four walls, sent inside forever, never seeing no
You have been listening to a DAKM Media production.